You are now tuned in to the Believe Network. Do you believe?
The podcast is brought to you by Hardwick.life, which is the website. It's the home of the Lose Like a Lineman program. And if you haven't heard of the program and you're interested in losing weight, get your butt onto the website at Hardwick.life. That's Hardwick.com, but it's Hardwick.life. And if you don't know already, I designed that program 6 years ago for my personal weight loss to get me down from 295. I went all the way down to 202. I lost 85 pounds in under 5 months, and it's given tons of success to a lot of people. And we've just, and you'll hear about this on the podcast with Jamie, we have just redesigned the program, Lose Like a Lineman 2.0, specifically with the female in mind and the female's preferences and what is manageable. So that was with Jamie. She helped me out with that. And she's going through the program right now and having a lot of good success, as you will hear. So check it out at Hardwick.life. Enjoy the show, guys. Hey, gang. Welcome to the Hardwick Life Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Hardwick. Joining us today on the podcast is Dr. Osama Kaki, MD. Dr. Q, as you're going to hear me refer to him, is an interventional cardiologist. He is the medical director of the cardiovascular intensive care unit at Ascension Hospital in the Detroit area. He is also part of a team opening a new facility in the heart of Detroit called the Detroit Cardiovascular Institute. Dr. Kaki is going to share with us some eye-opening information about what is called peripheral artery disease. It's a common circulatory problem in which narrowed arteries reduce blood flow to your limbs. When you develop peripheral artery disease, otherwise called PAD, your legs or arms, usually your legs, they don't receive enough blood flow to keep up with demand. And it's commonly associated with diabetics, and it can result in what can be described as heart attacks of the legs. At the Detroit Cardiovascular Institute, they specialize in treating PAD through a minimally invasive technique called atherectomy in lieu of the traditional form of treatment, amputation, which you're going to find out has a bunch of serious repercussions after that. We get into all sorts of topics on this one, like who does it affect the most? How do you know if you should get checked? You're also going to hear me get personal with the questioning and how it may relate to a family member who seems to have some of the similar symptoms. So we take this serious conversation in all sorts of fun directions and throw out a bunch of ideas and theories and hypotheses and talk about health in general. Dr. Q is awesome. And I think you can never hear enough from caring, impactful, and intelligent people. And Dr. Q, certainly all of those and more. Guys, I hope you learn a lot and I hope you enjoy. Right. Dr. Q, give us a little background on you if you don't mind. Help us set the stage a little.
Well, man, how far back do you want to go?
Where'd you come from? How did cardiology become your thing? How'd you become an interventional cardiologist?
Wow. Okay. Let me try to shorten a long story. Okay. Without having to get too sad here, but I
Don't psychoanalyze yourself, but we'll take the story.
You know, I didn't want to be a doctor. Actually, I'm not sure what I wanted to do. I did fall in love with architecture, but I did like people. And the more I got to know about becoming an architect, the less interested I was becoming in the field, right? So around that time, my father was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And it ended up taking his life. I was about 21 or 22 at the time, just about the time where you're trying to make decisions on the rest of your life.
Right.
He wanted me to be a physician. And at the time, I think, you know, a combination of sort of granting his wish, but at the same time, understanding or becoming more of who I am. I thought that maybe helping people was my calling. I felt that it was something I could be good at. I enjoy being around people. I enjoy helping them more than anything. I couldn't offer that to my dad. I think that was very upsetting to me, but at the same time, I think it was the driving force of making me who I am. And so therefore I decided to pursue a career in medicine. I went to school briefly out of the country for about 2 years, and then I came to Detroit for the latter 2 years of med school, and it just kind of took off from there. I did my residency in Detroit. I did my fellowship in cardiology in Detroit. I enjoyed the complexity of the heart, and so then I and therefore I pursued my career in cardiology. Then I went into interventional cardiology. I found myself being, lack of a better term, like good at doing procedures. And it was at the same time gratifying that somebody could come in pain, or you know, something life threatening, and you can provide them with instant relief. And there was just something so gratifying about that.
I'm sure.
I think going into being an oncologist or a cancer doctor, I thought that would have been difficult for me, you know, considering my personal experience. It wasn't my calling. This felt more of what I want to do, and I'm enjoying every minute of it. I love what I do. And I can't express that enough. And
I can completely understand. I mean, you almost get that immediate gratification of, hey, somebody may be coming in, having a heart attack, having an issue going on, and you're able to do something almost immediately that gives them their life back.
Right.
Like that's got to where, and I can see too, with the history of your dad, and I'm sorry about his passing, that the oncology, it's such a struggle, right? And it's a long process to hopefully return somebody back to good health, where it seems like a lot of the work you do with the heart, at least saving somebody or opening up blood vessels, is, you know, one of those that can happen fairly quickly. Tell me what you guys got going on. I see the logo. People who are watching on YouTube, the Detroit Cardiovascular Institute, the logo's right behind you. It's a super cool logo. Tell me what you guys have going on there.
I decided that I wanted to open up my own practice. I've done a little work here in the community. I've done a little work in around the suburbs of Detroit. I found myself not being able to do what I wanted to do. I wanted to be patient focused. I found myself more or less running around, and I wasn't spending enough time taking care of people. I think.
And is that just being a part of the big medical institution?
It's part of being either part of a private practice or part of an institution. Part of sometimes medicine in general these days is that we forget that medicine is an art, and by that I mean anyone can essentially diagnose somebody, right? You can run some tests, you can diagnose them, and then you can fix them. I think what I was missing was being with people. I think listening to people, I wasn't able to sit down and listen to their story, and then treat them. You're not treating a number anymore. You're treating a person. And I wanted to kind of refocus, you know, my career in that aspect. Again, going back, I did my entire training essentially in the city of Detroit. I found that we weren't doing that enough. We weren't listening to the patients. And by that, we weren't taking care of them. I think, you know, I think that's missing, and I want to bring that back. I you know, I don't know if it's a trend. I know people do that. It is, but it's a passion of mine. It's people, right? I get to sit here and we can talk, whether it be friends or family, sometimes a stranger, they come into your world and they want to tell you a story. And sometimes, honestly, I get patients, that will come in, not because something's wrong, but just because they want to talk. Yeah. Maybe because they missed me, or they want to, one lady brought me a painting, right? And she, and that was it. And she came, cool. She made an appointment with me just to bring me a painting. And I think more like, it makes me feel good that I can provide that, to somebody.
And I think there's two, and you know better than me, but I just heard recently that there's research now going into patients who feel like they are cared about, not just cared for in a medical sense, but like the doctor and the nurses care about them. Their outcomes long-term they have a lot more success when they feel a personal connection to somebody who will listen to them and will hear their story and will ask them questions other than, medical type checklist questions. That I think the research is pointing to exactly what you're talking about is the art of the science.
Right. The quality of their life is what we need to focus on. It just doesn't come in. For example, someone has a heart attack, for example, it just doesn't end there. You don't fix them and then they go home and then, the disease doesn't progress, or right. You have to focus on their overall lifestyle. You don't just, continue to schedule appointments later on down the line, ask them a few questions and then say, hey, let me see if I can fix you. And then, right. And then I guess kick the can down the road until they come back with another issue later. I feel if you can focus on them individually, and their lifestyle and their goals, I think you have better outcomes. And that's essentially what we got into it for. Right. Is to make them better, make them feel better, right? I want them to come in and be treated, but I want them to go home and then continue self-care. And that requires a little bit more involvement from our end. This is essentially the project. This is what
I want. That's great.
Our project, or what we're getting ourselves into is trying to help the community, essentially focusing on the city of Detroit. I am a cardiologist, but I'm an interventional cardiologist. I can focus on people's hearts, but I can focus on other things like peripheral vascular disease, for example, or venous disease. We can get into that topic, but it's a disease or diseases that are very prevalent, specifically in the inner cities. I want to give back to the city that gave to me all these years. So
what, describe the two that you were talking about, venous disease, and then is it peripheral artery disease?
The peripheral artery disease. So if you, so think about patients who have heart attacks, they'll tell you about plaque buildup in the coronary arteries. Okay. So over time, essentially since the start of puberty, you start building up plaque in your arteries. Then there are things that you can modify and things that you can't modify. For example, your sex or your age, your genetics, for example, these are things you can't change. You're going to get older. You're always going to be either male or female genetically, or your parents, gave you, to be blunt, bad genes, right? You can't run away from that, unfortunately, right? But there are things you can modify, things like exercise or tobacco use, or, if you're unfortunate and you have diabetes, you can modify your behavior so that you can prevent the progression of those diseases. That's plaque buildup in the heart. Well, what people don't understand is that, that can also develop in your lower extremities or in your
carotid. This is something that I had never heard of this.
Yeah. So plaque buildup, it can build up in your arteries, anywhere really. And typically patients who have coronary disease are likely to have peripheral vascular disease. Risk factors of such patients are things like diabetes or tobacco use, or you know, high cholesterol, for example, sedentary lifestyle. These types of things, you know, can drive disease progression. And you have to think about it is that it's like a patients who have chest pain, right? It's typically because of a blocked artery or plaque buildup in your artery. Well, you can have lower extremity pain, right? Leg pain, or patients, unfortunately, when they have strokes, right? That's plaque buildup that can occur. And so if you have like cramping, let's say in your legs or your calf muscles when you exercise, and you have some of these risk factors like diabetes or tobacco use, advanced age, for example, or high cholesterol, you know, like that could be a symptom of what we call peripheral vascular disease. And I think it's a disease that is underdiagnosed. We're not testing enough for it. We're not looking enough for it. And then therefore, as time goes on, unfortunately, patients tend to have amputations because of disease progression. That's never a good thing if you can think about what you do on a given day, right? Right. You were telling me earlier, like you were getting up and you know plowing snow, right?
Yep. Not plowing, Doc. Shoveling.
Shoveling snow.
Right? Oh yeah, we don't own a snow. We don't know a snow blower yet. Yeah. I am the plow.
Yeah. Right. So, but you know, like things like that, right? Like you get up, and you have to do things. You know, something basic as getting up and eating in the morning.
Anything.
Right? Anything.
Now imagine, taking a walk. Yeah.
Right. So imagine you lost your lower extremity. Let's say, you know, they had to amputate your foot because you had plaque buildup that wasn't taken care of. Imagine what that does to your everyday life. Right. And then imagine what that does to your psyche in terms of like depression. Right. You have to have somebody help you out most of the time. Right. You can't you have to ask patients to exercise for their cardiovascular health, but they can't. Right. It becomes difficult. So these are the things that we're looking for and that we want to help, you know, this population. Now, you know, talking about peripheral vascular disease as well as coronary disease. Right. If you get up and you try to take a walk and you have chest pain, you're short of breath, it may be a sign that you have plaque buildup in your heart. That can very well be treated. And this way you can ask them to exercise, right? And if they exercise, maybe they can prevent plaque buildup in their lower extremities that would prevent them from ever, you know, worrying about an amputation, right? It's all tied together. It's just a matter of, you know, finding the, you know, the patients that have this and then treating them adequately so they live a healthier lifestyle.
How do the patients have any indication that this is a thing? I'd never really heard of it. It's all, you always hear about the heart. You don't really hear about blockages so much in the legs. I know that amputation is common amongst diabetics, but I didn't really understand why that was the case. How do patients know that this is even something that they should ask their doctor about? And I guess why are more doctors not looking into this as patients are coming to see them, or are they? I guess maybe that should could be a better question. Maybe they are looking into it, but what are some of the indications that somebody should perhaps ask about this?
So patients tend to, their most common symptom is typically pain or cramping in the in parts of their lower extremity when they walk or when they exercise. Sometimes it's when they run, right? And it's relieved actually simply by resting, right? So you get up, you go for a walk, you go for a run, and then you start having this cramping in your legs, let's say your thighs or your calves, right? Then you rest and then that goes away, right? That may be indicative of peripheral vascular disease, a blockage, right? That's what we call claudication. Okay. Sometimes it goes underdiagnosed because one, we're just not looking for it. Maybe we're focused on other things. Maybe we're just not asking the right questions. I think sometimes, you know, like, for example, you tell patients to, let's say, go for, like, are you walking? Are you exercising? And the patients will say, yeah, I am. And then we kind of leave it at that. And we don't really dive into, well, how often are you exercising? And what are you doing for exercise? You know, like, are you, you know, like walking on a treadmill for 5 minutes or around the block? I mean, that may not be sufficient, right? Depending on your age. I mean, if you're 90 years old and you're like, you go for a walk around the block, that may be pretty good, right? But if you're like 60 years old and you're going for a walk around the block, that's probably not sufficient enough for cardiovascular health. And so I think we got to dive deeper into some of these things. And that's essentially it. It's more or less that simple. Now, if they get to the point where they have, let's say, an ulcer on their foot or their lower extremities, right? It's not necessarily too late. It's just, you know, we probably could have caught it 6 months, a year before, to where it didn't have to get to that point, right?
What is the ulcer a result of? I've heard about this before. I guess I've never understood why the ulcer develops. What happens there?
So what happens is that it's lack of blood flow, right? Okay. Imagine like you got a blockage somewhere. You're not getting enough blood to that extremity, right? And then it starts to deteriorate, essentially, you know, and then it can become infected. Now, if it becomes infected and you're not getting enough blood flow, blood provides all the nutrients to heal, right? But if you're already compromised there, you're not going to heal, right? And that infection gets worse. And essentially, there's no other option but to amputate, unfortunately.
Why has amputation been kind of the go-to in that world? Why has it been so common?
Sometimes it is... Maybe it's just too late. They've gotten to the patient too late for them to do anything about it. If you can catch it early, you can prevent amputation. Sometimes it's more or less the provider may not think there's another option, but that's not true. And why I say that is because we can provide a service now where we can open up those arteries and restore blood flow to the affected area and then give it time to heal. Now, healing is not going to take place on its own. It's going to require, you know, aggressive wound care, someone to potentially have to go to their home and look at their wound, follow up with, let's say, a foot doctor to help treat that wound. It doesn't just end there, but if you can provide blood flow back to the affected extremity or the limb, you can potentially save that patient's leg or foot or toe, right? And then effectively save their life in the long run.
Yeah, we're going to get back to that last point in just a moment. What's the surgery that you would do in lieu of amputation called, and what does it look like, and what's kind of the rehab process out of that?
Okay, so when it comes to lower extremities, what we can do is it's called an endovascular approach. Okay, it's not surgical. We don't do anything open. There's no cutting involved. What we do is access the artery. We can actually insert a device into the artery itself, clean out the plaque and the calcium buildup in that artery, right? Restore blood flow with simple things like ballooning. They have balloons now and devices that you actually put in these arteries and open them up. It's actually
just like people would think with a heart attack.
Yeah, it's essentially the same, almost the same process, right? We go in there and we restore blood flow, and then the rehab process.
Same thing. Come from the artery in the upper leg or in the thigh and work your way down instead of your way up.
It's typically what we do is we get access to the artery in the thigh, or sometimes in the foot, just depending. Sometimes from behind the knee. I mean, we can get creative, depending on where the blockage is and how complicated or complex it is. Sure. And then we get access to the artery. We go down with various devices and wires and balloons, And we can open those up. You know, we have devices that shave the calcium down, which is pretty remarkable. It kind of gets rid of the calcium, and then you, and then almost the artery almost looks like new at the end of the procedure.
Wow, that's really something. And then what's rehab time, or is there a hospital stay even associated with it, or are they just?
No, in fact, these are same day procedures. You come in at your allotted time. Let's say it's noon. If the procedure is done in the next hour, 2 hours, you're home, you know, probably by 4 o'clock.
Wow.
And you'd be amazed. The patients actually will tell you they feel better almost instantaneously. You know, they'll tell you that, hey, I have a feeling in my foot. I was like, yeah, they'll tell you it's warm. I was like, yeah, that warmth is because we restored blood flow, and you're getting feeling back that you didn't know, you know, like you forgot that you had.
Wow. All right. Personal question here.
Yeah.
Dad had cancer. He had throat cancer about 4 years ago now that he ended up beating, radiation, chemotherapy, all that. But before they did any of that, they did a big PET scan of him, and they found two tennis ball size aortic aneurysms in his stomach. Okay. They had to take care of those before they took care of anything. Well, now, and he was a longtime smoker, like 3 packs a day guy.
Yeah, that makes
sense. He quit about when my oldest son was born 9 years ago. And so they took care of the embolisms, I guess they'd be called. I think that's right. Is that right? Aortic aneurysm. And he took care of the aneurysm. But since chemotherapy, he's saying, I have no feeling in my feet. And as you're talking about this, his feet are cold all the time and he can't feel them and he loses his balance in the shower and all this. And I'm like, this is now really interesting to me, because with the known, we have heart conditions in our family, and Grandma's had a quadruple bypass in 87. Grandpa had multiple heart attacks. Dad obviously had the prior condition and being a smoker, not overweight, but I'm thinking this may be something that he needs to ask about, is low blood flow in his lower limbs and potentially opening that up.
Right. You've described essentially all the risk factors. He's a male at his age, right? Three-pack-a-day smoker. He's already had peripheral vascular disease. An aneurysm is a subset of peripheral vascular disease. Okay. It's essentially from smoking, right? It destroys the intermuscular layer, and then it balloons out, causing weakness to that muscle. Now, if you left alone, that artery can burst, right?
Yep.
But he's feeling cold, in his lower extremities. It probably gets worse when he walks.
Oh yeah.
These are signs of PAD or PVD. And he should probably be worked up for it.
What would be the procedure? Go in, ask, hey, can we do an ultrasound or something of the legs?
So we have different procedures to kind of screen for that. Sometimes they can check the oxygen content of, let's say, your arms and your legs and compare the two. Similarly, they can check the blood pressure of your arm and your leg. If there's a discrepancy there, it may be that the artery or the blood flow in your leg is compromised. Very basic, very simple, non-invasive, doesn't cause any pain. There's no sticking,
right?
But it's a easily diagnosed disease process that can take less than 10 minutes to find. And it's you'd be amazed. Okay, it's interesting. We find them in the lower extremities. We can also find them in the upper extremities. It's although a little bit more rare. But yeah, that process is there.
Wow, that is fascinating. Do you think at some point, I know like life extension is like one of the things that everybody's searching for now. Like we're all, of course, naturally in. We don't want to die, but everybody now wants to live to be 120 years old. And I see a bunch of crazy kooks out there doing a bunch of crazy things. Do you think ever at some point that going in and using the tools that you have to shave off the calcium deposits in the arteries, or in the veins is going to be more common as a prophylactic procedure or as kind of a life extension type procedure rather than, you know, there's symptoms here that need to be alleviated?
Yeah. So if you think about it, there is mortality benefit to limb salvage or amputation prevention because of the quality of life, right?
Right.
I mean, your 2-year life expectancy after an amputation is unfortunately painfully decreased. And if you got to think about it, right? They don't exercise, they're depressed. These things, if you confound them, they can cause a tremendous impact on somebody's
speeds quality of it life. Speeds that process up. I tell everybody, exercise at the end of the day to add years to your life. Like, it is work now, but it does add years to your life. Cause the minute you stop exercising and pumping fresh blood and oxygen to your brain starts atrophying, your body starts atrophying, and you expedite the dying process, really. Right. So to your point of the amputation, that's yes, saving you for a moment, but then in the long, it makes it a lot shorter. In the end, it makes it a much expedited process, which is very sad.
Right. You bring up a great point. There is, there are amputation programs around the country. And if you look at what they're doing, they're showing benefit to preventing an amputation versus, not doing so. If you kind of let the disease process take place and it results in, you know, patient amputation, they can't exercise, right? You can't tell them to go out and exercise. In fact, right. You know, they start to gain weight. They can't do anything to lose that weight. Simple things, right? And it's one of those things, like we have to do something about it because it seemed to have improved for a little while, and now the trend is going back up towards amputation. And it's quite alarming. It's one of those things that we have to kind of tackle and take care of.
You mentioned taking care of the whole patient, right? And making sure that not only is the current issue that they're facing kind of solved, but then the whole life, the whole picture, are they in the long-term, long run, getting healthier? How do you manage the patients that come in that may have diabetes, and what kind of recommendations are we given to those folks to help prevent any further declination in their health and perhaps hopefully, you know, making life better for them? How do you handle that process? Cause it's super complicated, right? It's, you know, there's finances tied into it. There's culture tied into it. There's emotions tied into it. We obviously can't stop eating because we have to live. Like, how do you help patients manage if they need to lose weight or if they need to get a grip on exercise and eating better? What kind of recommendations do you give to people?
Sometimes, unfortunately, it's access to educational resources. We in the city of Detroit actually have resources built in that will help patients, or at least provide education to patients to help them with things like diabetes or tobacco cessation, for example. There are physicians that specialize in diabetic care, endocrinologists, for example.
Yep.
The internists, especially in the city of Detroit, are well equipped to manage diabetes just because they see it so often. So regular office visits, right? Things to prevent, right? We want to prevent amputation. We want to prevent complications from diabetes. We want to prevent complications from tobacco use. I mean, you were alluding to your father earlier, throat cancer, right? These are things that can be preventive. If we do a good job providing that information to patients, right, and they take that information to their home, right? And then they take it into their community, right? And then the community changes, right? And then, you know, through that, the disease process will hopefully change, right? If you can change one, right, and they can take it home and change others, right, then you start seeing less of this. If you start seeing less of this, then it makes our job so much easier. Right. I never want to be in the business of doing this, right? I would love more than anything if a patient comes to see me and says, "Hey, I've got no complaints today.
Awesome.
I'm just coming here to say hi. I'm telling you, I feel great. I just want to get a checkup just to make sure everything looks good, nothing's changed, and then go home." Right? Those are the best, right? Those are the best visits.
Yes. Rare though,
right? Because yeah. That makes you feel that between you and your patient that we're all doing a good job. And if we can get to that, then we can change something. And that's our ultimate goal here.
Where are we? Because it seems like there's so much information out there, right? On how to live a healthy life and how to take care of yourself and how to exercise. And I know at times it's confusing. It's like, there's so much information, a lot of conflicting information, a lot of people who, you know, beat on one drum and the other folks beat on the other drum and you got to do this and you got to do that. I get that, but there is a lot of information out there. Where are and how are people falling through the gaps with the education? Because I do believe, and I'm with you, that knowledge is power and educating people is the most important thing, because then, like you said, one person goes out and talks to five people and those five people go out and they talk to 25 people and it just becomes exponential. And that's what we would want. But where are we as a society, as a nation, and a lot of just as a world, like, where are we failing? Like, and how do we puncture through whatever it is that is preventing the information from getting to the people who need it the most?
I think sometimes it is, you have to build into the patient, into the community, self-interest in their overall health. You have to be able to talk to them and reach out to them. They have to absorb that information, right? And then take it upon themselves to be active in their overall health. Now, sometimes that's easier said than done, right?
Right.
I could probably ask you, where's the nearest gym or grocery store, right? And you can probably tell me something within a 5-mile radius.
Yeah, I'll give you 15 of them within a 5-mile radius. Yeah,
in the inner cities, that's not a resource that a lot of patients have, right? You have access to a gym because maybe it's something that you can afford.
Yes.
And, right, you can go. You have a gym membership.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like on.
Yeah, I have one at home. I have one up the street. I can go get a membership. That's
right.
Exactly, but, right.
Even if you have access to a gym, can the patients afford it? You got to understand that, like, a lot of these patients have to choose between putting food on the table or a gym membership, right?
Right.
Putting gas in their car or, getting a healthy meal.
Oh, yeah.
These are choices that patients have to make, and they have to make the choice to survive. I don't know. I'd like to go to a place in society where we can provide that for patients. How fantastic would it be if through, let's say, insurance, every patient had access to a gym, right?
Right.
Like, imagine, like, they would essentially, there's no reason for them not to, right? I mean, they would have to obviously cut out time in their day, which is another factor.
Yeah, time is a factor. For sure.
And to look after themselves. And it's something as little as 20 minutes, right? 20 minutes, three yep. times a week, right? Like,
that's, you
do a good cardiovascular exercise, 20 minutes, three times a week. You can dedicate 1 hour of your time in a 5 to 7 day period, right? That's enough.
Yeah, that's good.
Right.
That's good. That's more than enough. Yeah.
If we can figure out a way to make you know, food more readily available, or at least more accessible.
More accessible, yeah.
You know, healthier options to the population that you're treating. You may make some inroads. So,
what do you recommend, or what are the other doctors, perhaps, that you know, the internists, the endocrinologists, that you may outsource some of your patients to? What do they recommend from a nutrition standpoint for people that are of lower income? Because it is really easy for me to go, well, hey, you eat like this and you're going to get healthy. When in reality, it's like, yeah, you eat like me, you've also got to afford that. And I do realize that that is not sustainable. It's not an option for a lot of people. So I think it's, you know, important to ask questions is, how can people of lower income eat in a healthy manner?
Right. I guess you have to look at the quality of the calories that they're putting in, right? Yep. If you can eat a vegetable, you know, over, you know, that can probably fill you up over, you know, a candy bar or a piece of cake, or, you know, maybe let's say an unhealthy sandwich, for example, right?
Right.
It's the quality of the calories that you're consuming per day that we have to look into. We have information on that. We can provide information on that. The patient's physician, the primary care doctor or endocrinologist can provide that kind of information. But I think, you know, it's cheaper to buy a loaf of bread, for example, than let's say, a thing of vegetables.
Right.
You know, like you want to tell them to stay away from, like, let's say canned vegetables because of the salt content, for example.
Sure.
But it's cheaper, and it's more cost effective for them to buy that. So they, you know, even though they're eating vegetables, there's an unhealthy component to that.
Yes.
I think that's the crisis of our time, is to figure this out.
Yeah.
We talk about the cost of healthcare and the skyrocketing cost of healthcare. And I don't think we pay enough attention to prevention. If we can prevent, you know, someone from getting peripheral vascular disease or coronary disease, right? Or cancer, for example, these things, diabetes, if you can prevent that from happening, imagine how much money you would save, right? Because it's money for the insurance companies. It's money for the healthcare or the health industry. If you can prevent these illnesses, imagine that's less hospital stays, right?
Yeah.
That's less medications that they'll have to take. If we can only refocus that as a society, maybe then we take better care of our patient population. As I was alluding to before. Get them a gym membership, right? Imagine like if it's, you know, 15, I don't know. I mean, there's gym memberships for as low as $10 a month out there, right?
Yes. Yeah.
That's a lot more, it's, you know, like, imagine like someone's medication that would cost them hundreds of dollars a month, or cost the insurance companies, right? Hundreds of dollars a month. Look right there. If they can just get healthy and feel good, right?
Yeah.
Get
off some of these just getting in the door. So, you know, you set this type of thing up, and of course, all hypothetical, set this type of thing up to create a healthy habit. You start going, even just to check in, right? Like, you have to check in a certain number of times a week to be able to receive the benefit. There is so much research going into it now. That, and this is from Atomic Habits, that if somebody will set the lowest goal possible, I'm going to go to the gym for 2 minutes today or 5 minutes today, right? Like, you have to go check in, you have to swipe your card, but just going there is an accomplishment. And then eventually you're like, oh, hell, I'm here. I might as well do something, right? Yeah. And then you get surrounded by other people who are taking care of themselves, and you start asking questions. And that may be the easiest way for $9.99 a month, right, to get people started down that path.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds It's easier said than done, right?
Easier said than done. Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of bureaucracy to cut through there.
Right. But can you imagine? Like, I agree with you. Just get them in the door. And maybe you can attest to this. Going to the gym or doing exercise, not necessarily going to the gym, but just exercising frequently becomes almost addicting, right?
Oh, yes, very right? much. It yes. takes a while for it to become addicting, though.
It does. Yep. And it's very easy when you fall off that wagon to not realize how addicting it was, right?
Yeah.
I used to go to the gym all the time or exercise all the time quite frequently, and then I loved it. But then obviously through my career, I had to, you know, and now I have a
now with a 3-month-old.
I have a 3-month-old, right. I had to take a break from that. And I think about it quite often. And it's one of those things I want to get back into doing, obviously. But if I can convince people that it feels good. And then you want to do it and you feel terrible not doing it. I mean, what a feeling that would
yeah.
be.
Right? And that is the hardest thing about creating healthy habits is healthy habits take a lot longer to pay off to feel that reward.
Right.
Where bad habits really pay off instantly. Right? Like, like playing PlayStation pays off instantly. You get a dopamine hit. Eating junk food pays off instantly. Smoking a cigarette, drinking a beer, having a shot, smoking weed, whatever it is. Like, those are instant dopamine splashes in your brain. So the reward's immediate, but the ramifications are massive down the line. But healthy habit change, it's like, well, actually, I felt like hell after that workout because I hadn't squeezed my muscles that hard in a long time. And then it took 3 days before I felt better. But then 3 months down the line, when my weight came under control, my brain was firing on all cylinders. It's like, oh, there's the payoff, but it's a long haul. And then in the long run, you don't have the negative health side effects that you do if you are instant gratification.
They forget what it felt like to be a kid. Remember when you were a kid and like you couldn't wait to like get up and go and play outside.
Oh,
and
yeah.
All you did was you ran around and whatever, you were obnoxious, but still there was a reward to that. Like it felt good. And then life catches up to you. And you have priorities now and whatnot. So you just have to get back into that a little bit each day.
A little bit each day. Yeah.
Right. And it pays off. Right.
I call it recess.
Yes.
Exercise. It's funny. We own gyms out in San Diego and regular listeners will be like, Nick, quit talking about the gyms, but we do. And I love working out. It's like, it's where I play. It's like kind of what I've learned, how I've learned to use the tools. And I just like to play, but it really is recess. It's where you see adults in group fitness spaces a lot of the times. And it's like, hey, they're just getting their beans out. Like, hey, go get your willies out, you know, go have some fun in the gym. And that's, you know,
right. I'm the type, look, I have a hard time kind of being, you know, like solitary and doing my own workout. Like I need,
totally.
It has to be like, for me, like I have to be doing something with like other people. Or you know, sometimes just a pickup game, right? Pickup game of basketball, you know, like whether it be outside or inside, good time, right? At least for me, like everybody's in it together, and then it feels great afterwards. But
you get into that group flow; it's super fun. You feed off of everybody's energy; it's total blast.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you could just get people to do that and do that more often, you know, more often than not, obviously, you know, like to have a gym, you know, people will get gym memberships and then, you know, it's like that January influx of people that you know, like the New Year's resolution, right? They'll get the gym memberships and then they stop showing up. Right. And I mean, like, if you can just get them to show up a little bit each day, right. I found myself, I was more productive in a class type setting than I was, you know, essentially doing something on my own. Well,
yeah, totally. You have so much on your plate, right? Sometimes it's just nice to have somebody else tell you what to do.
Yes.
Just tell me what I need to do. Yeah. I can give good effort, but just please tell me what to do.
Right. Keep me occupied for like an hour and then I'll be on my way. But yeah.
Yeah. Where you're telling everybody else what to do all day long. Hey, do this, think about that, do this. You know, sometimes it's nice to just give the control over to somebody else. And it's like, could you beat me up for an hour? That'd be great.
I know. I'll find myself trying, if I'm alone, I'll like find a reason to be on the phone. I don't want to get into that. Just, obviously, you know, it's totally good advice, but still, you know, you get together, you get with some friends, you take your family, right? Like go in there, make some goals, right? Yeah. And cut out a little bit of time. I was talking to a married couple right before I got on the phone with you, and they go to the gym together, right? And they encourage each other, and they do it together, and it's as little as 20 to 30 minutes. They go in there and do some exercises, they feel good, and they come home, and they do about 5 days a week, right? If you know, like you can do that with your significant other, or your best friend, or your brother, sister, your parent, your kids, if they're interested, depending on how old they are, obviously, right?
Yeah. You know what? An interesting thing that my wife has started with a lot of her friends is like, hey, we don't have to go out to dinner. We don't have to go out to drinks to get together. Can we go do a physical activity? Can we go on a nature walk? Can we go to the gym? Can we do a yoga class?
Yeah.
You know, you can, there's other ways to get together with your friends rather than just going to have a beer. We don't always have to just go have a beer, have a drink, you know, do something unhealthy. We can also be friends and do something healthy. Hey, yeah. Dr. Q, we're coming up on time. Where can people learn more about what you guys are doing at the Detroit Cardiovascular Institute and all the amazing work?
Yeah. So we'll have a website that we're going to share with you. And I think you can share with your listeners up soon. You know, we have an office in the city of Detroit, just downtown, where you can come and see us. And in today's age, obviously, you know, with the telehealth, we can set up appointments and do something just like you and I are talking right now. They have, they have software that we can do that. And we're doing that actually more often these days.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. I love talking to people. If somebody wants to have a chat, just like you and I are having, you know, this married couple that called me earlier, it happened to be one of my wife's friend's parents, that they were, you know, they wanted to talk to me about something. No problem. You know, like I'll carve out some of my day just to have a conversation, as long as they feel better. And their lives change. If I can change people's lives, then we're all better for it. All right. There's nothing more gratifying, I think, than, you know, getting to know someone by their first name. You know, they come in and you recognize them, and they tell you their story. And, you know, like, you know about their kids, right? You know about their jobs. You spend less time the trick for me is if I'm spending less time talking to them about how bad they feel, right, then we're doing a good job, right?
Yeah,
they're not feeling bad, right? They just want to talk, and man, does that feel good, right? And if I can share that with anybody, you know, like if you could do that every day, you know, whether you're a physician or not, right, make somebody feel good. Yeah. It is as gratifying as going to the gym every day.
That's it. It's
that addiction, you know, that dopamine, right?
Yeah,
so
changing the world for the better.
Absolutely. Yeah, we all have to play our part, right?
That's it.
Right.
Yeah. Play your strengths, do your part, and that's fantastic. And thank you. I'm gonna get off of here and call my dad and say may want to look into this.
You have my number. Again, if he wants to want me to talk to him over the phone, absolutely.
Very cool.
We're more than happy to talk to him and see if I can kind of direct him in the right direction. All right.
Yeah. Very cool. And I don't know if Dad listens to this, so sorry to put you on blast, Dad, but the information came and I had to, you know, it's just, it kind of hit me. It's like, oh, wow, cool. This is very, very useful information for me personally and for a lot of other people listening. So Dr. Kaki, thank you so much. We will put the information to the Detroit Cardiovascular Institute. We're going to put that in the show notes. So if anybody wants to reach out to you and is not maybe in the Detroit area, that's okay. Telehealth, absolutely, like you said, is
doing it all the time. We'll set up like an email by which if anyone of your listeners have questions about their overall health, or maybe I can give them some direction on where to seek help, I'd be more than happy to do so. All right.
Good. Thank you, Doc.
Hey, no problem. You guys take care. Right.
Yeah, greatly appreciate it.
No problem. All right.
All right. Care. Bye-bye.
We made USAA insurance to help you save. Take advantage of discounts when you cover your home and your ride. Discover how we're helping members save at USAA.com/bundle. USAA. Restrictions apply.